Hi, podcasters. This is Andy Studnit, editor of Applied Clinical Trials, and I'm here today with our editor-in-chief, Lisa Henderson. For today's episode, we are speaking with Dr. Sean Bowen, CEO of Olema Oncology.
Prior to his time with Olema, which began in 2020, Dr. Bowen spent time with Genentech, AstraZeneca, and UltraBio. And throughout his career, Dr. Bowen has made significant contributions to the clinical research and development of numerous oncology drugs that received regulatory approval for various indications, including HER2, metastatic breast cancer, basal cell carcinoma, bladder cancer, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, mantle cell lymphoma, melanoma, non-small cell lung cancer, ovarian cancer, and prostate cancer. So thank you for joining us today, Dr. Bowen.
It's my pleasure.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Bowen. I guess we'll get started with maybe what might be the most broad question that we have for you today, and that is, did you always want to be in the field of medicine?
I didn't always want to be in the field of medicine. I always wanted to be in a scientific field. My mother has a drawing from kindergarten where I have a lab coat on and in what looks to be a chemistry lab. I have no idea where I got that idea from, but certainly in a scientific field, the inspiration for medicine probably came, you know, more when I was an undergraduate and studying science, but looking at how it could be applied through the practice.
Excellent. So I guess that lab coat and the chemistry lab did come to pass, right? Because you have an MD, PhD. So you have the medicine and biochem?
Yeah, I have an MD and a PhD in biochemistry, both from the University of California, San Francisco. And yes, spent lots of time in the lab.
And which do you like better? I don't know.
Yeah, it's not really how it works, I don't think. I think they are really complementary. I use both, though I don't spend time in the lab anymore and don't spend time in the clinic anymore. I stopped clinical practice, probably about 10 years ago. But the knowledge and experience that's derived from both, I think, are things I use every day.
So as Lisa mentioned in her part of the intro, you moved into the industry with Genentech in research and early development. So if we could just go back to that, primarily, what did that role entail for you?
Well, my first role at Genentech wasn't actually in the research and early development space. My first role at Genentech actually had a bit more to do with, we didn't call it this at Genentech, but it would have been called medical affairs. What it entailed specifically was really educating physicians on a relatively new drug at that time, which was called Rituxan, which is an anti-CD20 antibody for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And I did that for not quite a year and then moved into the early development and early drug development space at Genentech.
So medical affairs and educating physicians. So that's a natural fit, right? Because you're a physician, you can speak their language, right? And then you moved into the research and the early development. So what was that like?
Yeah, I mean, I think the medical affairs position is a natural fit. It's an area of academic expertise for me, both lymphoma and anti-CD20 antibodies. The real application of the scientific training to clinical practice, though, comes through clinical development and a lot of it at early stage clinical development. So for me, it was a pretty natural transition to go into the early development direction and be more connected to the research organization. The interesting thing is that I still, to this day, am informed by the experience I got through medical affairs because it really does teach you how practicing oncologists process information, learn new things, and use that information to make treatment decisions for patients with cancer.
Did it feed back into the responsibilities that you had in the research and early development? How did that relate back?
Yeah, it's less that it feeds into the responsibilities, but it sort of informs the kinds of decisions you make because in the medical affairs context, you are really learning about how physicians learn new information and how they prioritize the data that's been generated to help them make treatment decisions and recommendations for patients. And what that informs is as you're going through the process of drug development and designing clinical trials, you are able to use your understanding of how physicians process information to really generate information that's useful and impactful for them.
So you mean in like the endpoints you choose or the investigative sites that you choose?
It can be in all kinds of things. It can be in looking for biomarkers or patient selection strategies. It can be in endpoints that you use. I mean, obviously, some endpoints are required for approvability of a drug, and safety is always a very important endpoint. So you have that. But also things like patient-reported outcomes. How do patients feel when they're on this treatment? How do they feel about any side effects they may experience? Is there an opportunity to better understand the treatment by understanding which patients benefit most from it? All of that gets incorporated.
Excellent. Thank you. So when you moved into AstraZeneca, you were the Executive Vice President, Global Medicines Development, and Chief Medical Officer. So that's both then, right? You're doing kind of what you did in your two roles in Genentech and just lump that up and together, right? That's like development for all medicines and being the chief medical person, the medical liaison for the company?
Yeah, so not so much the medical liaison for the company, but you mm-hmm. make the decisions around sort of the benefit risk assessment for all the medicines that the company has approved or that the company is working on to get approved. And yes, you are correct. It was for all therapeutic areas at AstraZeneca. At that time, that was quite broad, but there was the primary foci of the company were oncology, metabolic diseases, and pulmonary diseases at that time, with some broader autoimmune disease investigation going on as well.
Excellent. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Bowen. Correct me if I'm wrong, but Olema is solely for women's cancers?
Well, it's not quite that. Our focus is on cancers that occur primarily in women.
Okay.
And the reason I make the distinction that it's solely on women's cancers is what that does is that directs you to certain signaling pathways or molecular defects that are prominent in cancers that occur primarily in female patients. You won't be surprised to know that some of those same signaling pathways and mutations in the cell actually go to cancers that aren't particularly predominantly occurring in patients of one sex or another. I will also add that our primary clinical program is for estrogen receptor positive breast cancer. And it's important to recognize that while that primarily is occurring in women, about 1% of those cases occur in men.
Yeah, I remember reading that. So recruiting for the cancers that occur in women, are there any specific recruitment challenges?
Yeah, I mean, I think the recruitment challenge that's primary for clinical trial conduct in cancer in adults in particular is that the vast majority of cancer patients, particularly in the United States, never participate in a clinical trial. They really don't have access to clinical research. Beyond that, for us, specific considerations are, while breast cancer is the second most common cancer diagnosis in the world, there is still a lot of competition for the smaller group of patients who participate in clinical trials. And then for us, obviously, we're focused on estrogen receptor positive, HER2 negative breast cancer, which is about 75% of breast cancer, but still, again, is a subset.
So you're using biomarkers to identify the patients?
Yeah, they're pretty well-established biomarkers, right? Estrogen yeah. receptor, progesterone receptor positive, HER2 status. Those are pretty broadly accepted in the characterization of breast cancer.
So why do you think there is a challenge in recruiting adult oncology patients?
Well, I just think that many of them aren't treated at institutions where mm-hmm. clinical trials are conducted. And so I would say that access to clinical trials is probably the primary obstacle. As well, you know, some education about clinical trials is something that needs to, I think, be done more proactively, more thoroughly as well.
I would agree with you. So tell us more about Olema and just where your main focus is for this year and, you know, what you're working on. I know the trial, obviously your trials are in progress. So just can you tell our audience about your company more?
Sure. As you mentioned already, we are a biotech company focused primarily on women's cancers. Our lead molecule is a clinical stage molecule. It's actually a phase 3 ready molecule. And that molecule is called OP-1250. It is a complete estrogen receptor antagonist. It's also a selective estrogen receptor degrader. And as I mentioned, our primary focus of treatment right now is estrogen receptor positive, HER2 negative metastatic breast cancer. A phase 3 trial with OP-1250 will begin mid-year this year. We are also studying it in combination with CDK4/6 inhibitors. These are another pathway that is inhibited in combination with endocrine therapies. And using the CDK4/6 inhibitor plus an endocrine therapy is the first standard of care treatment for advanced or metastatic breast cancer. So our objectives this year are to, you know, we've treated over 160 patients with single agent OP-1250. That enables us to start this second, third line therapy pivotal trial mid-year this year. And then also we have our ongoing trials with two different CDK4/6 inhibitors. One's called palbociclib, one's called ribociclib. So we're enrolling more patients there. And then also with a PI3 kinase alpha inhibitor called alpelisib. So that clinical development activity is our prime activity for 2023. We do have a pipeline of molecules in research heading toward the clinic as well, also focused on women's cancers, but that's a little further off.
So you said you're enrolling the phase 3 in mid-year?
We will begin enrollment mid-year. Mm-hmm. That's right.
And the standard of care is the second one you mentioned, the combination?
Yeah. So the standard of care in second, third line is endocrine therapy. So we'll go against existing endocrine therapies in that case. In the first line setting, so if when you were first diagnosed with metastatic or advanced ER-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer, the standard of care is to get one of the CDK4/6 inhibitors mm-hmm. in combination with an endocrine therapy. Currently, now that's usually kind of a treatment called an aromatase inhibitor. And the reason that that's preferred with the CDK4/6 is you get an all-oral regimen. Mm-hmm. You have no injection. It's all pills that the patient can take, which is much more convenient.
Gotcha. And metastatic breast cancer, so is that's like stage 4, right? Most of your patients are well
Most of our patients are stage 4. That's right. Okay. So that either they were diagnosed with advanced disease so that the cancer is, you know, has left the local area of the breast mm-hmm. tissue and lymph nodes, or they were diagnosed with localized disease and treated, you know, possibly with surgery and or radiation and maybe some adjuvant treatment, but they then subsequently relapsed with metastatic disease.
Yeah. Well, you're doing really important work, Doc. I mean, you've already treated many people in your life, practiced, and, you know, done so much research. You must have a sense of what? What do you have a sense of?
Oh, well, I have a sense that OP-1250 is going to be a drug with the number of patients we've treated and the level of activity and tolerability we've seen. And it's going to help patients with an unmet need. And so that really is what gets you up in the morning when you go into this business. Obviously, drug development and trying to control cancer is not easy, but it is extraordinarily satisfying when you are fortunate enough to actually be able to make a real difference there.
So Dr. Bohm, really, I mean, thank you so much for being on our podcast, and thank you so much for your work and, you know, contributing to, you know, human life, really, seriously. Thank you.
No, it's a privilege. You're welcome, but I feel very fortunate. So thank you, and thank you for taking the time and the interesting questions. I do appreciate it from both of you. Thank you.
Yes, thank you so much, Dr. Bohm.